This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. If you like this show, you will love the changelog. It's news on Mondays, deep technical interviews on Wednesdays, and on Fridays, an awesome talk show. That's a lot like JS Party, now that I'm thinking about it. Find us by searching for the changelog wherever you listen to podcasts. Big thanks to our partners at Fly.io. Launch your app in 5 minutes or less all around the world. Learn how at Fly.io. Okay, hey, it is party time, y'all.
Okay, friends, one thing I'm obsessed with now is using Notion AI. Yes, I'm a Notion user, a power user, I would say. I use it for myself, I use it for changelog, and it's just so effective to organize everything. And with the addition of Notion AI, it is a single tool that does it all. It searches across Notion, other apps, generates docs in my own style, it analyzes PDFs and images, and it can chat with me about anything. Now, you may know Notion as the perfect place to organize your tasks, to track your habits, to write beautiful docs, and all the things you could do with Notion. But adding Notion AI with the context of your work is simply revolutionary. And unlike specialized tools or legacy suites that have you bouncing between 6 different apps, Notion is seamlessly integrated, infinitely flexible, and yes, it is beautiful on the eyes. And yes, I am obsessed with Notion AI because I could pretty much ask it anything and it's just there for me. It's super fast and is relevant to all of the stuff I have inside Notion. You can try Notion today for free when you go to notion.com/JSParty. That is all lowercase letters, notion.com/JSParty. Try the powerful, easy to use Notion AI today. And when you use our link, you're supporting this show, which is awesome. Notion.com/JSParty.
People. I'm Jared, your internet friend, and I'm joined today by half of the team behind an awesome document called the 9 Node Pillars. Maybe you've heard of them. Matteo Colina is here. What's up, Matteo?
Hi, Jared. Very happy to be here again. Everything is absolutely fantastic. I just came back from Ireland for the Node.js Collaborator Summit and NodeConf. It's been a blast.
Nice. Always a blast to have you, Matteo. Frequent guest here on JS Party, and a first-time guest, Natalia Vendito, who is the lead owner of the JavaScript DX and DevTools at Azure. Natalia, welcome as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here. I'm very excited.
I'm excited about this document, this piece of work you all put together, because I think it's excellent for giving people foundations on building Node apps in a proper enterprise-ready way. We're going to dive into hopefully all 9 pillars. I might take them out of order, because some of them are very generic and I think apply to many kinds of applications. And then there's some like node specific ones. I would love to hit the generic ones first so that we make sure we get to all those and then loop back around. And you may disagree with me on that, Matteo, but we'll get into that.
I do agree with you.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's get started.
So first, let's hear about quickly how this came together. You have 4 people writing a document. Whose idea was this? Why did we write it? Et cetera. How did it go?
The main idea was mine, okay. Essentially. We started to coalescing a lot of ideas about, like, I've been doing this as for a long time and helping doing consulting before Platformatic, my startup. I did consulting for a long time, and basically I collected a lot of bad experience on what companies do wrong with Node.js. And then I decided, there's a lot of bad opinions out there, okay? So maybe we should spread good opinions. So what can I do about it? Okay, and I said, well, if I just write them, then maybe it's just my opinion. Let's take a group of people to write them, okay? And therefore, here we are. At the beginning, I think there were less than 9. There were
5.
We started with a lower number.
a little bit of scope creep.
Then we became 9, and 9 was at least a good number.
That is a good number, especially because of the alliteration. 9 node pillars. Natalia, how did you get involved?
Well, I've been collaborating with Matteo for a while already, ever since I joined Azure, but I think a little bit earlier, also following him because of his work in the technical steering committee, and I've been working with Node.js for a very long time, actually in enterprise for more than a decade as a webmaster of the time. Way before that, that wasn't with Node.js, but anyway, with JavaScript. And yeah, I've also seen everything, all the pitfalls, all the bads, all the goods, actually leading a consultancy at the front end team or front end department with a consultant back in the day with leading enterprises doing a lot of stuff that, yeah, basically ruin their applications and try to inform people how to not make the same mistakes they did and we did, right? Because I'm not going to say I never made any mistakes. I probably made a lot of the mistakes we're trying to avoid people to make in the future.
Sure. You can't really know good until you've known bad. You know, like you've made the mistake and you're like, oh, that's not good. Let's not do that anymore. So this is very much the hard won learning process. And not all of us have to go through it every single time. Of course, certain things you have to learn on your own. But if you can glean from people who have made the mistakes how to avoid them in the first place, then you're ahead. And so I'm glad that you all put your knowledge into this 9 node pillars. Now, I want to take them out of order, but are they ordinal? Like, is it 1 through 9 and 1's the most important, Matteo? Or can we?
No, I don't think so. It's let's put it that way. Marketing decision on the orders of them. There might be something that comes before the others, but it's mostly put on what would resonate more for people and at the beginning.
Gotcha. So I'll read through them real quick. We will then discuss as we see fit. No way we're going to be comprehensive and cover all 9 in extreme depth. That's what the document is for. So of course, to our listener, if you've learned something from this conversation, go dive deep into that and pull out some gems. But the 9 node pillars: 1, do not block the event loop. 2, monitor node specific metrics and act on them. 3, use node LTS versions in production. 4, automate testing, code review, and conformance as much as possible. 5, avoid dependency creep. 6, de-risk your dependencies. 7, avoid global variables, config, or singletons. 8, handle errors and provide meaningful logs. And 9, use API specifications and automatically generate clients. There you have these folks' 9 pillars of good enterprise-ready Node.js apps. Now, I think some of these are good for pretty much any application. I think some of these are node specific. Matteo, did you agree with me? I couldn't hear what you said. Did you disagree with me on that?
No, I absolutely agree.
Oh, okay,
some
cool.
of them are, so there's a thing to say, okay? Some of them are like the principle might be generic,
right?
But a lot of the content within the section is node specific. So while the principle might be generic, the content in there as node specific example on how to implement that principle in Node.js. So they were worth mentioning anyhow.
So let's start with ones that I think are the most generic, and we can dive into all the nodey details. And those are the ones like avoid dependency creep. This is 5 for you all. And certainly that to me is like a universal thing for all software development. Avoid dependency creep. Say more, Natalia. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What do you think about this particular pillar of Node.js apps?
People that work with me know I'm a hater sometimes because I try to avoid dependencies at all costs. And of course, you're not going to reinvent the wheel and write whatever it's already written and maintained by other people. And you know that it's reliable and you can add to your code base. But I think that we tend, and I'm going to say we, because it's an ecosystem problem. We tend to add dependencies where we don't need them. We tend to not consider the cost of maintenance. We tend to not consider the cost of being tied to a piece of code that somebody else is leading or has control over the roadmap of. Yeah, and that's something that we need to keep under control. And that's what we are trying to, and that's, you're absolutely right. That's not only a JavaScript ecosystem problem. It's a software development or web development in general problem. But yeah, it's a very, very important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. And I've spoken with hundreds and thousands of devs and we all kind of agree on this. And yet we all find ourselves still with unwieldy dependencies. So Matteo, maybe the question becomes like, how? Like, we agree that we should, But how do you actually decide? How do you do that?
There is a tube. There is a very important thing to say, okay? NPM, the JavaScript community and NPM have solved a problem that plagued the industry for decades. Okay, how to reuse software at scale? And this is, you know, but, you know, whenever there is, you know, a big problem to solve, you need to say, okay, be careful what you wish for. And now we have node modules full of modules that maybe we use, maybe we don't. Maybe we can get without, okay? And there are a few things to say. A lot of the time, some of the modules might not be necessary anymore because we have been adding APIs to Node.js Core for a long time. And also the web has been adding APIs itself. And therefore, you know, let me make a very clear example. Fetch is a fantastic spec, is a fantastic API. Everybody loves Fetch, okay? But whenever I open an enterprise code base, most of the time I see Axios. I'm pointing at an example, and I love Axios. I like Axios, okay? I'm just saying.
Sure.
It's an example. Or, you know, I've opened a code base recently, and they still use the request module. Now, I just want to check how many times the request module, which has been deprecated ages ago, is still used every single day, mm-hmm. okay? Because it's actually a very good number. The request module is still downloaded 70 million times per week, okay?
Wow, that's astounding.
And it's been deprecated for 5 years. Mm-hmm. 5 years, this thing's been deprecated and is still being downloaded 17 million times per week. Okay, this is this is the problem that you need to keep those APIs condensed and try to reuse them, but you know, being you know smart in what makes your choices what you do today versus the choice you do in 2 years. Okay. Things changes and you need to keep your code base liquid in that sense. You can put things in stone. And a lot of team put things in stone and say, this is our kit and we decided it 3 years ago, but you don't need this anymore. We decided it 3 years ago and the staff engineer said so.
Right.
Yeah. And this is why we're big proponents of web platform, right? Because first of all, go and check what's there. That's future proof. And then go and find it somewhere else when that's not supported natively.
Are there heuristics or best practices that you can give regarding dependency selection or that choice to go search NPM versus just coding something? Is there a certain size or a difficulty level of a feature where you say, you know what, grab a dependency, like Fastify, for instance? Mateo, you're not going to say I should go roll all my own routing and HTTP stuff, or you're saying probably grab Fastify most likely.
But you probably should. It's a lot of fun.
I probably would if I had the time, you know, because I do. I like having fun.
You see?
Yeah. So, I mean, how do we, you know, that moment, that threshold, how do I decide? Like, yeah, I'm going to go grab something versus I should just build this.
I tend to not reuse with write code. So if I find something that meets my standard, I reuse it.
Okay.
I use it from NPM. The question is my standard is pretty high, and therefore I am like whenever I use something, my question is, okay, if I adopt this, will I be able to maintain this thing? And this is the question that everybody needs to ask when they adopt a piece of software, especially a company. Okay, if the thing is small, the answer is always yes. If the thing is big, then you need to ask, okay, I cannot maintain this. If I not maintain this, then who can? And how can I get them access? And, you know, then it gets to, you know, who I need to pay, essentially, as a company.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is important. Company versus individual developers is a different mindset. You need to reason about this long-term stability of your project. So if there is a problem and you don't know how to solve, what to do. I've recently been very, very, I am in a fork frenzy. So a lot of the time I like a module, but maybe I don't necessarily agree on some of the choices of the maintainers, and I just fix it, make it my own, and that's it.
Fair. Well, that leads us to our next one. We could definitely do a whole episode on this topic. And our next pillar actually is on the same topic, which is de-risk your dependencies. So, Mateo, you're kind of talking about dependency risk. You fork it and maintain it yourself.
Yep.
Larger the dependency, I think larger the risk. There are some things you can look at with regards to bus factors, for instance, like how likely is this to get abandoned? But de-risking your dependencies, Natalia, this is pillar number 6. Speak to that point.
You know, in enterprise specifically, I think that one of the suggestions or things we would like to encourage stakeholders to do is to get more people involved in open source, because you cannot understand the risks of using code that you are not involved with. So if you're using XYZ, or you decide you're going to be using XYZ module, go and investigate about it, get involved, understand the activity in that repo, understand the security concerns that people may have brought forward for certain choices, design choices, architecture choices. And that's one way of de-risking. And the other one is making sure that you understand that code base that you're integrating, because you are going to have to debug it. You're going to have to maybe make the decision of patching something on your end. And if you have to do that, you probably want to contribute back upstream, right? So everybody benefits from whatever you have solved, whatever problems you have solved. But yes, definitely getting to know the code that you're going to use is a, and then keeping an eye on the, again, on the ecosystem at large, because whatever vulnerability you're going to have in a dependency, it might be a vector to access other parts of your application, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Let me make a very simple example here. As all of you know, Express have been rebooted. The project had a change in leadership. And one of the things that the new leadership did as soon as it got on the driving seat was to publish a flurry of CVEs. Now, a lot of people have known of those CVEs for those vulnerabilities for a long time. And what was the problem? Well, because the project was not in a good position. So this is one of the important things to look at. Is the project well maintained? Are the maintainers can do their things? Tools can help you a lot. Like tools, tools is the minimum, but you need to go, do more than the tools. Okay?
Yeah.
The tools help, but tools help after the problem happened.
Right.
Okay? Tools are like, pam! And this is the famous meme of the duct tape. Okay. And slap it on there. Okay. But you need to look at the problems beforehand most of the time.
Yeah. To add to Natalia's statement around getting to know the code and to de-risk, get to know the maintainers, get to know the team behind the thing, you know, hop in their issues and say hi, or just read about the reasons for their motivations, who they are, why they built it. You know, some people just put their intentions. I plan on maintaining this for the next 10 years, or this was me scratching my own itch. It's free for you to use, but I'm done with it. Like those kind of things are very useful to know in order to de-risk. So get to know the code, but also get to know the team or the individual. You don't have to be on a nickname basis with them, like Mateo and I are, for instance, my Fastify maintainer. But I know a lot, you know, I know the team behind Fastify, and that gives me confidence in the project. So.
Well, friends, I'm here with a friend of mine, Michael Greenwich, co-founder and CEO of WorkOS. We're big fans of WorkOS here. Michael, tell me about AuthKit. What is this? How does it work? Why'd you make it?
WorkOS has been building stuff in authentication for a long time, since the very beginning. But we really focused initially on just enterprise auth, single sign-on, SAML authentication. But a year or two into that, we heard from more people that they wanted all the auth stuff covered. Two-factor auth, password auth, you know, with blocking passwords that have been reused. They wanted auth with, you know, other third-party systems. And they wanted really WorkOS to handle all the business logic around tying together identities, provisioning users, and even more advanced things like role-based access control and permissions. So we started thinking about that more, how we could offer it as an API. And then we realized we had this amazing experience with Radix, with this API, really the component system for building front-end experiences for developers. You know, Radix is downloaded tens of millions of times every month for doing exactly this. So we glued those two things together and we built AuthKit. So AuthKit is the easiest way to add auth to any app, not just Next.js, if you're building a Rails app or a Django app or a just straight up Express app or something. It comes with a hosted login box, so you can customize that, you can style it. You can build your own login experience too. It's extremely modular. You can just use the backend APIs in a headless fashion. But out of the box, it gives you everything you need to be able to serve customers. And it's tied into the WorkOS platform, so you can really, really quickly add any enterprise features you need. So we have a lot of companies that start using it because they anticipate they're going to grow up market and want to serve enterprise. And they don't want to have to re-architect their auth stack when they do that. So it's kind of a way to like future-proof your auth system for your future growth. And we have people that have done that. People that started off and they're like, oh, I'm just kicking the tires. I'm just doing this. And then poof, their app gets a bunch of traction, starts growing. It's awesome. And they go close Coinbase or Disney or United Airlines, or, you know, it's like a major customer. And instead of saying, oh no, sorry, we don't have any of these enterprise things and we're gonna have to rebuild everything, just go into the WorkOS dashboard and check a box and you're done.
Aside from the fact that AuthKit is just awesome, the real awesome thing is that it is free for up to 1 million users. Yes, 1 million monthly active users are included in this out of the gate. So use it from day one, and when you need to scale to enterprise, you're already ready. Too easy. You can learn more at authkit.com or, of course, workos.com. Big fans, check it out. 1 million users for free? Wow. WorkOS.com or authkit.com.
Another good pillar of many applications. Number 7, avoid global variables, configs, or singletons. Now, this was yelled at me very loud by my university professors, and I didn't really know why, but they're like, globals are evil. Globals are evil. And I was like, okay, I won't use them. And here we are, years and years and years later, and y'all are saying, don't use globals or avoid them. Say why? Why? So they're so handy. They're so useful. They're so easy. Who wants to take that one?
Go ahead, Mateo. Since you're hitting yourself.
Mateo's hitting something on his head as I talk.
I am literally like, this is insane, okay? The amount of JavaScript application on Node.js that are full of globals, the stick database is in the global scope. Mm-hmm. The stick that you know, they do require through how the system back and forth without any possible control of how the data, or how the project is booted in setup and so on and so forth, it's everywhere, okay? Code base that are becomes an absolute mess in no time because, you know, oh, I need some data that's part somewhere. Oh, I just export it from my module and then require it from somewhere else. Job done. And then, I don't know, 10,000 iteration later, the code base is unmaintainable. Mm. And now it's a problem of Node. And, you know, and Node that makes all the problems. And therefore, you need, you know, whatever else to fix it. And turn it into, you know, move it from JavaScript to TypeScript, yeah, something like that. But reality is you probably did not apply any structure to your code. This comes from the history of JavaScript, okay, on the browser. We can use globals, okay? One global, one user, one global. Oh, okay, fine. I can put the auth on my other. On Node, probably not, okay? And then in order to support this pattern, we had to invent all sorts of things to make it, you know, feasible for users to use globals without having actual globals, so they can, you know, they can have a nice DX, and a nice DX is called having globals now, okay, for some frameworks. But the reality is we have a lot of async local storage magic behind it to make it happen. Popular framework, and just if you want the headers of a request, you can just call the headers function, export them from a module. You get the headers. Fantastic, right? How come, like, to make that happen, okay, there is a lot of state being handled behind the scene, so the right requests get the right headers. And it's a lot of complexity behind it, a lot of performance that's being lost by providing this kind of developer experience, okay? Mostly because developers love globals, okay? And it's
we do. We really do. It's we're so convenient.
It's if you want to avoid this kind of stuff, don't do it, okay? The other problem is Node Env equals production. This is another one of mine. I don't know, Natalia, you want to talk a little bit about this disaster, No Damn Vehicles production?
Say more, Natalia.
I think that you were very good at explaining why No Damn shouldn't be used, and I would like you to elaborate on that. But okay. One thing that I really like that you made a distinction about was the use of globals in the browser, the use of globals in Node.js in the server. That's two different stories, and we've seen a lot of over-engineering on the browser side to manage state, which I don't want to talk about because I'm going to... But that's for another chapter, right, Jerob? Another episode. Uh-huh. But yes, exactly. It's very, very important to not pollute, to understand scopes, right? Before you start, before you start writing JavaScript, and I got a lot of also people angry at me for saying that before you learn frameworks, try to learn those mechanics of JavaScript.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Mateo says something very interesting, which is, I think, how we get into this mess, is that what works in the small does not work in the large. And what he said was 1,000 iterations later or something like that, where it's like when you started, it made sense in that small little, this is just a single file. I'm just running a little node server. I'll have a global for my database. It'll be fine. And it is fine at that scale of code. And then we take that and we just like one by one add to it. We kind of grow these organic applications out of a single file. And 1,000 iterations later, you have a huge mess on your hands and you did not think about the structure ahead of time when it was small, and it comes back to bite you. And of course, blame the runtime is what Mateo said. But it happens a lot. It happens a lot. And so how do we avoid it? Well, you have to kind of know what your app's going to turn into eventually and maybe add some structure up top, or just avoid them altogether, or set NodeEmv equals production at all times. This is what this document says, Mateo. Why?
Well, the NodeEmv production is one of the biggest example of this pattern failing spectacularly.
Okay.
At some time ago, long time ago, a friend of mine, Tim Caswell, decided to add NodeEmv equals the NodeEmv environment variable to a library called Connect. I don't know if you ever were doing JavaScript when doing Node with Connect.
I remember Connect, and I know Tim. We've had him on the show, but lots of people probably don't, so feel free to fill in the gaps.
Ah, it's fine. Okay, so Connect was the predecessor of Express, early days, okay? By the way, Tim Caswell, hi, you are great. You did a fantastic job.
He's awesome.
You did a fantastic job for the community, so I'm sorry to put you on the spot for this thing. But he created, it added this idea of, you know, we need to have this library make some different choices between the development environment and the production environment, which makes an absolutely, it's a great idea. Okay, we need that. We need that in all our code. Mm-hmm. Any app these days has a development mode and a production mode. Okay,
yeah,
this is great. The idea is great. Then something horrible happened. A few people thought, oh, but that's an environment, so I can add a staging environment and have the configuration of my database be selected by that same variable. Mm-hmm. And that's the disaster happening. Mm. Because the ops people think that the environment is a server running somewhere. Mm. The JavaScript people think that the environment is my computer. And it's basically a big language barrier, big language problem of an overlap of two terms with two completely different meanings.
So to resolve that, you just set it to production at all times.
Everywhere, yes.
Don't use it.
And there is a specific module called, I think, config that use that library. Don't use that module, please, guys. You will make yourself big in trouble. There's a lot of people using it, by the way.
How then do you go about achieving the same goals of like, well, it's different in dev than it is out there in the real world?
No, you can use whatever you want, really. You can even use NodeEmv with that specific meaning. But then you have two meanings. It's either dev or production. There is no staging.
Okay.
Because then your staging makes nothing. Okay. Because a lot of libraries in the ecosystem will react to that specific environment. Mainly react in that specific environment specifically. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's if you don't set it, you will get very different results. So you need to always set it for your when you are deploying on a server, that needs to be always set, even if it's your staging environment.
Yes.
Otherwise, your staging environment is not equal to your production environment, and then you are in trouble.
I've actually fallen into that exact trap where I had to stage an environment, but I had to set the environment to production in staging in order to get it to look like production. I can't set it to staging because things don't work. So I can feel what you're saying. I felt it and I agree with it. Singletons, same story, different thing, right? So pretty much the same. I think we can skip that one. Let's move on entirely, lest we don't get to all nine and I become a liar. Number eight, handle errors and provide meaningful logs. This just sounds like, you know, breathe, eat food, put one foot in front of the other. But sometimes we have to state the obvious. And oftentimes as devs, we're in a hurry. We have things to do, features to ship, and we have a propensity, I'll admit it, to being a little bit lazy sometimes. And, you know, that error is not going to happen very often. What's the big deal? Natalia, you want to kick off on this topic? Handle errors and provide meaningful logs.
Even if the error happens once, that's it, right? But
just once.
Yeah, just once. I think we are not good sometimes at handling errors all the way from the database, the API, and the application. Mm-hmm. So we should start there, very low level, and go up. And of course, you need to create meaningful logs in order to simplify your life at the time of debugging, but also right. because we're building applications that are going to interact with users, right? And you also want to pass that to the client and make sure that everyone understands what's going on at all times. It's essential. Error handling is, like you said, like breathing for developers. It should come naturally. Yeah. It should be top of mind and never a second thought.
It's certainly part of your application. I'm not too big of a person to admit that I've just punted on errors plenty of times throughout my 20 plus years of coding. Most of the time when I don't do something with the error, it's because I just don't know what to do. I'm just like, what am I going to do if this actually is an error? I don't know. Console.log error and move on. Mateo, do you have advice on error handling? I guess it's very contextual, so maybe you can't give generic advice, but like, have you ever come across a situation and you're like, I don't know, if it's errors here, what do we do?
The biggest problem is knowing that somebody will catch your errors.
Mm.
Like, especially with long promise chains and long async await, you need to know there is somebody at the end catching your things.
Holding the bag.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The other point is implementing a graceful shutdown pattern. It's very important for your application most of the time, unless you don't want to do that. But I will not get into that case. So when an error happens, okay, and is not caught, it will crash your system. It will crash your node server. Now, what you want to do, you want to try to land as gracefully as possible, which means typically stop accepting new connections, stop accepting new requests, process what you have in flight, okay? And then
exit.
And then exit, okay? But don't, you know, otherwise, if you have 10 connections running at the same time and you cut them, they will not get anything in their hands.
Right.
So that's typically the problem. Like, a lot of people solve this problem by saying, I'm just running Node.js in my Lambda and I fixed it. Well, they pay for it, but yes, that's a fix. But otherwise, you probably want to close with grace. You want to.
Do you see that often? Just this lack of graceful exit out there? And
all the time.
Really?
Or implemented incorrectly, which means okay. All the time.
Is it hard? Like, it seems like ChatGPT can do that for you.
ChatGPT cannot do that for you.
No?
No, it's not good enough.
Okay, what's good enough?
No, there is a module linked. So read the document. I wrote a module, but there are a few that are identical. Okay, if you use the module, then you're good. But there is a few edge cases that you need to keep into your head when doing these things and play it well with, I don't know, with Kubernetes and a lot of the other ecosystems like that.
All right, so the moral of the story here is npm install close with grace. Is that the module you're talking about, close with grace?
Yeah, that's the one that I wrote, yeah.
There you go. One more dependency, ain't going to hurt you. Go ahead.
This is a good one. This is one that we allow.
Okay. You also have a subsection here about what to log. Do you want to get into that? Because sometimes you're logging too much, sometimes you're logging not enough. There's log levels. It gets very detailed, but I'm not sure if we want to open that can of worms here on the show. What do you think? Read the document.
Yeah.
Read the document.
Read the document. Let's move on. Pillar number 9, use API specifications and automatically generate clients. This is a very opinionated one because, you know, automatically generated clients can be not so awesome at times. But what if you don't like the API spec? What API spec should I use? Why can't I just hand roll a thing? It's all JSON anyways. Who wants to pick this one up? Because I think I agree with you, but I can see myself skipping this one in my own applications.
Do you work alone all the time? Because I don't know.
Yes, that's why yeah. I skip a lot of ceremony because I do. So yeah, I'm not your target audience because this is for enterprise apps.
Yeah.
How, so fair.
You need contracts. How else are you going to agree on what the shape looks like of your API? There is none.
That's true. So don't listen to anything I say. I'm coming from the indie side. Go ahead. Tell us. You need contracts. You need to have an agreement, yeah. right, on what it's going to say. And you don't want to have to just invent that every time.
Right. And you want to be consistent across your many APIs, right? You want to use the same patterns. You want to make sure, you want to use the same exceptions. You want to make sure that mm-hmm. you are, that anybody that comes to work with you will understand right away how to create that connection, server-client or server-server or whatever.
So how do I pick a spec? There's OpenAPI, there's GraphQL.
For me, it's OpenAPI, but I think this is something we don't necessarily agree with, Matteo.
Okay.
We might be in agreement, but yeah.
Yeah, I
let's hear it.
I'm a restful person.
Natalia says OpenAPI.
Yeah.
I say OpenAPI.
Oh, look at that.
What do you say, Jared?
I want to say GraphQL. No, just kidding. I just wanted to have some disagreement on the show.
Oh, I like GraphQL. I like both, to be honest. It really depends on the application. Can't really just use something, okay?
Just use something and then auto-generate the clients. So what do we use on that side? I think there's probably proprietary solutions. There's probably lots of ways you could get that done.
I have a maybe biased opinion, but we are working on an open source generator, emitter, API shapes thing at Microsoft. It's called TypeSpec. Mm-hmm. It's a tool to define an API specs. And generating code.
Is it out there?
Yeah. TypeSpec.io. Actually, I'm going to be speaking about it in an upcoming conference, TypeScript Paris. So yeah, we're just rolling it out.
Cool. I'll scoop that one up for the show notes as well. TypeSpec.io. Matteo, do you sign off on this? Do you use something else?
I've never, to be honest, it's on my to-do list to play with that.
Okay.
I am more of OpenAPI fan generically, mostly because it comes from connected to JSON schema and it's all integrated well and nice. Okay. I also really like GraphQL too, depending on the, on what we need to do as part of an application. What's the use case? Okay. So there are certain things that are better specced as GraphQL. If you don't know how the data will be queried, probably GraphQL is the right choice. If you have a variety of different clients and, teams are disconnected with each other. Otherwise, the OpenAPI is actually pretty good. So it depends on the company, on the use case, depends on the business, depends on a lot. There's no one size fit all in that discussion. Just use something. At some point I was chatting and every single time, because of the process that they had and all the boilerplate that they need to do, they needed to add one more API call from the consumer front from a company I was consulting with. It took them 4 hours.
Wow.
Right? Like, it's literally money burned. Like, they're literally burning money.
Mm.
And it's like something, this is something that a computer should do. There's no, maybe even ChatGPT is a good generator. I have no clue. Okay. On that, like, yeah. That can be even going to the point of, if I need to unroll it, I'd probably try to ChatGPT it mm-hmm. because it seems, a lot of work to, a lot of busy work, okay? I'm not delivering anything of value at that point.
Yeah, I don't want to hijack the conversation of the pillars, but we also wrote them because working in enterprise, you understand how this is something that stakeholders, like economic buyers, like the ones approving the time of developers need to understand. Because sometimes developers go and say, I need XYZ time because I need to write the specification, because I need to write error handling, and so on. And they're like, no, you just need to get the feature done and roll it out. And no, because that's going to cost you more money. You have the idea that you're going to be faster in the market, but then you're going to have to solve a lot of problems that you didn't want to deal with at the design specification and architecture decisions phase, which is an error.
Yeah.
A big, big error.
Goes back to a saying I've been repeating for years now, which is slow down to go faster. And it's difficult to get that across, but it's 100% the way to do software is slow down to go faster. Well, let's go faster. Now we've reached the end. There's one more generic one, but I'm going to save it for the very last because we don't want our listeners to fall asleep on us, you know, talking about testing and stuff.
What's up, friends and party people? Adam here. I'm sitting with Danny Grant, co-founder and CEO of Jam.dev, one of our new sponsors. Yes, Jam.dev is one-click bug reports that devs love. It's just too easy. Get Jam for free today at jam.dev. So Danny, how do you explain what Jam is and how it helps teams be more effective?
Jam is the fastest way to capture a bug in a way that developers can debug it faster. It's a browser plugin that hooks into DevTools. So when anyone on your team spots a bug, they can one-click capture what happened on the screen, plus everything in DevTools, console logs, network requests, session information, and it grabs it into a link so that when you open up the ticket, you have every single thing you need to debug. You don't have to ask a single follow-up question. This is for teams who want to spend their time building new features, not fixing old ones. I think that the most impact a software engineer can have is on building the future for their customers. It's on making things easier. It's building what's next. And so we want to make sure that you're not spending your whole afternoon just trying to repro a bug. Instead, you have everything you need to just get started.
Okay, friends, go to jam.dev and learn more about what Jam is doing for teams to make bug reporting and all that fun stuff super easy, super fast. Get Jam for free today, jam.dev. Again, jam.dev.
Let's go back now to what I call the node-specific ones, although maybe not necessarily node-specific, but more node-specific. Back to the top, number one, do not block the event loop. Of course, other things have event loops, but node certainly does as well. Yeah, this seems like a good one to put in number one. So who wants to kick off on this topic?
Well, do not block the event loop. It's one of my favorite, I can be a catchphrase, okay?
Yeah.
If, like, most people do not realize how the event loop works. Mm. And that's the reason why it's number one, to be honest. When there is, your code is executing, you're not receiving any, doing any IO. That's the key part of the event loop. And lots of people don't understand that. And they don't think that that is a problem. So they don't think that, I don't know, if something takes 50 milliseconds of CPU time to get done. They think, oh, it's pretty fast. It loads super fast on my machine. How come it's super slow in production? Because, you know, 50 milliseconds is not a good, it's a small number, right? It's not, you can perceive it locally.
Yeah.
However, on a server, 50 milliseconds, okay, means that, you know, you can do 20 requests per second on a single machine. Mm. Now, is 20 requests on a single machine fast or slow?
Slow.
And that's the point. But if I try locally, oh, it's 50 milliseconds, it's super fast. Mm-hmm. Okay, like I was in a few of those debates, okay? And then it's that's a major problem. How you can solve it, do it, you know, there's a lot of tricks and they're listed there, but that's the generic part is be aware that that's a problem. And if you think that, you know, most of the time the solution to your performance issue is the most obvious one, you have architected your application wrong. And you need to rethink your system so that it does not block the event loop.
Natalia, anything to add?
Yeah, I agree with Matteo. And I think that there are several people trying to educate the community on how the event loop works because it's so essential to write everything in JavaScript, understanding how in Node.js, of course, how the stack works and how things move forward or get stuck and why, and how to make sure you're not causing those blocks. But yeah, essentially also my favorite one.
Is there low-hanging fruit in terms of the how? I know that the doc has the details, but is there like a common thing that people are always doing? Or is it just not understanding the event loop itself is the common thing?
Not understanding how it works is a common thing.
All right. Well, get out there, folks, and understand the event loop, and you will save yourself a lot of pain.
This might also be that because you understand your event loop, you might make different choices in the libraries that you're going to use. Because most of the time, the problem is in your choices. You made choices, you thought something that was very good according to some parameter, then you learned something else, and then you say, ouch, maybe I made a mistake. Okay, well, at least you know now.
And you can fix it.
That goes to one of your bullet points there in terms of things you can do is monitor event loop utilization. And you point out a few tools you can use in order to understand, you know, if you have no event loop problems currently and you pull in a dependency and now you have event loop problems, that's a pretty clear reaction to that. And if you're monitoring that, then at least you can see when that thing explodes and or slows down.
Yeah, Mattia, I think you had suggested some tools.
We are moving essentially to pillar number two, which is a good segue.
Okay? Yeah.
Monitor not specific metrics and anchor them. Okay. The biggest number, like whenever I'm very often I'm called, still called to do, can you do a consulting for me? My Node.js process keep crashing. Okay. Or is having poor performance, whatever. Well, you know, what are you using to monitor and evaluate the performance of your system? Well, I'm using generic metrics provided by Kubernetes. Well, you know, you're driving, you know, with you're trying to make choices of your road with a blindfold. So what you expect, you crash. Okay. You try to drive with a blindfold. You're looking at the wrong things. You're literally not watching what you need to be watching. And that's essentially what this principle is about. Specifically the event with the event loop. You need to know if you have a Node.js application in production, you need to know what's the health of your event loop and act on it. If you don't act on it, you're screwed. And that's, you know, you have no traffic and you have no users. And if you have no traffic and no users,
nothing happens.
I built a few websites like that. No traffic and no users. Yeah. I've
done no that resources before. Use.
Yeah. Just everything's humming along nicely.
Yeah.
No, the load average is really low. What are the key metrics to watch then? What do you care about in a Node app? What are the key metrics?
Well, I said event loop utilization is this new metric that we added recently. Most people don't know about it. Mm-hmm. Read, study, guys. It's basically a percentage of the event loop that is processing events. Okay. It gives us a very immediate number. Then we want memory, but not RSS. Residence set size. Don't use that. That's a horrible metric. Okay. You need to keep an eye on that. But to be honest, that's not the important one. The important one is heap use versus heap total. Because Node.js will use all the memory that you give it to it. If you take Node, you say, okay, Node uses 1 gig. Okay. Yes, Pac-Man. Yeah, Natalia. Yeah, it eats all of it. Okay. Mm-hmm. But then it manages it. We've seen it all of it with Chrome. Okay. When you open a lot of Chrome tabs, each one of them consumes gigabytes and gigabytes of memory, guys.
Right.
It's horrible. Anyway, track how much of that memory is actively used. Okay. Track that.
Gotcha. So when your Node server starts, it is going to allocate for itself a certain amount of memory, and it may be over allocated by a lot. It could say, I'm using 1 gigabyte of RAM.
No, it's not like that. It's more, you have 1 gig, you know, typically it happens in this way. Okay. You have a chunk of your application. You can name it a part of the application that allocates a lot of memory. Okay. That memory does not get cleaned up very quickly. Okay. So, and then basically the garbage collector of V8 thinks, well, you know, cleaning this thing up is going to take a lot of time. So I'm going to park it there. And, you know, maybe in later on, I will have time to clean it up. Mm-hmm. And then, but there is memory available in the system. It's free. I can just get it. So I'm getting more memory. It's very lazy.
Pac-Man.
So, and then it eats all. Yeah, Pac-Man.
Right.
Prefers to eat, instead of cleaning it, you know, it looks like, to some extent, looks like a teenager that prefers to you know, do something else than cleaning up your property room.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Get some new clothes out versus cleaning the ones that are laying on the ground.
It's exhausting to be cleaning up. So I'm going to just use whatever is out there, free for me.
Yeah. There you go. So the key there is heap used versus heap total. You're going to get less information out of the resident set size, which is unfortunately also RSS, but not really simple syndication. Of course, in context, it is not confusing, but for us just talking about it, perhaps it is. And then of course, like you said, the event loop utilization, that's probably the big one. And then of course, CPU usage, like overall processor being used, right? Like typical stuff there. All right, let's move on to pillar number three, use node LTS, long-term support versions in production. This one seems like to me as the most enterprisey of them all, but Natalia's got the facepalm going. So I'm thinking people should just do this. And
yeah, I have seen so many instances of, you know, you're analyzing an app that is not working, and then you go and check what version of node they're using. It's of course 15, 17, 19.
Mm-hmm.
But why? This is
but why? Well, I can answer that. I mean, because, you know, that new one had something fancy in it that I wanted to use, right?
That's right. But not in production, right? Until it's released in LTS.
So what does LTS give us over non-LTS for those who don't know how Node gets released?
Well, first of all, the release cycle, the long-term support, which is 18 months right now, Mateo?
It's and current version is 6 months. Then it's supported for another 2.5 years after that.
Oh, 2.5 years. Okay.
Yes. So
3 total years?
Yeah, 3 total years. Yeah. But it only gets 12 months out of that as active LTS, which means it gets backports of new mm-hmm. features and things. It's great.
And non-LTS gets something like, I think you wrote 7 months?
6 months. So 7 months. 7 months. 1 month is, I would call it 6 months, but yeah, 7 months.
Why sure. 7 months? That's so arbitrary.
Because it's 6 months. It's 6 months plus 1 month of grace time in which we also fix security vulnerabilities.
Okay.
Mm,
okay.
For the slow pokes.
Yes, for the slow folks. But to be honest, I would just cut it. I would actually remove that. If I had an axe, I would axe it.
Yes. If you were the node release.
I'm not. I don't do node release.
BDFL or something, you would just axe that, but you were not.
Yep.
All right, so LTS, longer support, you get benefits like reduced risk of breaking changes, enhanced security, improved stability. And Natalia just says, why not? Why not just use that one and get all of the goodness in production versus the 6 or 7 month one? 6 month if Mateo's in charge.
And there's also people that use LTS, but they use it for 10 years, right? And so they are... And so they're on version 10 now. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Keep your versions up to date.
There you go. Now, how is Node with backwards compat? Like, as I get newer versions, am I breaking major changes all the time? Is it a huge pain in the butt to upgrade? What's your guys' experience there?
I maintain the thing, so I can't, to be honest. We try not to break anyone most of the
You're
time.
You're too close to it to answer that.
I am too close to it to answer that question. So I okay. am. I hope not, but if we do, we are sorry.
But mm-hmm. you need to consider there's going to be a point when you cannot offer backwards compatibility, because otherwise you would never introduce any innovation, any changes in the specification. Like, how do you do that? There is no way. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to. It's one thing or the other, right?
You want to innovate. You want to change. You want to get that.
That's the problem.
Get that TypeScript support in there, right? You know?
Yeah, but that's not breaking.
No.
No.
It's not breaking because you don't use it, because you use a flag not to use it, right?
That's right. It's opt-in, so it's not breaking.
Well, I've been a laggard on the TypeScript group, so.
That felt like a personal dig against you, Mateo.
Oh, yeah. She absolutely knows how to dig it. I know.
I am JavaScript all the way, so.
Yeah, she's poking the finger at me on the TypeScript stuff. She's Microsoft, so come on. What can you expect?
No, but I am JavaScript. I'm the JavaScript side.
Oh, you are? All right. Well, we have 3 JavaScript users here. I'm also not on Team TypeScript, but mostly because my co-host, who's not here, Nick Nisi, is the biggest TypeScript fanboy you could possibly imagine. And so we can't have that much agreement on the pod, so I just refuse to use it for that principled stance, pretty much only. And the fact that I don't like Ceremony, and like you said, or I said earlier, I'm kind of an indie dev, so I don't need all of the hunky-dory team-oriented things, you know? Which leads us to our last pillar, which is also generic, but I left it for last because, you know, it's like eating your broccoli. Although, general tip on broccoli, if you don't like it, actually eat it first because when it's cold, it's even worse. Right? When it's warm, at least. So here we are. Automate testing, code review, and conformance. Oh, that's three pieces of broccoli. Why? Why do I have to do it? Can we just skip that one, Mateo? A test in production.
YOLO.
YOLO. That's right. That's right.
If you care about your job, don't do that. As a good generic principle of life.
Yeah, I agree. If you care about your body, you eat the broccoli, right? So I hear. It's good for you. Natalia, what's your take on?
You don't have to love it, but you have to do it.
You don't have to love it, but you have to eat it.
Yeah, I don't love it. I am not the big, like, I am the person that always finds somebody else to write the tests because I don't love the broccoli. But you have to do it. And that's it. There's no way around it.
What's the conformance part of this? Code review, I understand. Testing, I understand. Conformance.
Oh, you need to have standards. You need to have...
You're talking about linting and stuff like this?
Well, yes, but you have to have conventions. So, yeah, you need to have conventions. You need to have standards. You need to... I mean, internal standards to your company that you agree to, that put everyone in the same page on how we're going to do this, how we're going to write this, how we're going to understand each other when we're writing code. And reviewing it,
gotcha.
Right? How can you review something if you don't know what's right and what's wrong?
And this is the world of tooling, right? Like, tools help a lot with this. Otherwise, it would be like a bunch of nitpicky code reviews of saying, hey, we don't put our semicolons there or whatever. So like linters, style guides, prettier, etc. Also, probably some bigger architectural documents where you decide, here's how we're not going to use singletons. We're going to read the 9 node pillars, stuff like that.
Yeah, we're not going to block the event loop.
We're not going to block the event loop. You have some sort of chant that the whole team does at their stand-up, right? We will not block the event loop, like Bart Simpson writing it 100 times on the chalkboard.
Exactly.
I will not block the event loop. All right, so that brings us to the end of the 9 pillars. I thought we did a pretty good job covering all those. Of course, the details are what matter, and they are in the doc, so we didn't want to just read the doc to you all. We want to talk about it. What about pillars that didn't quite make it? I'm sure this is a collaborative process. I know you went from 4 or 5 up to 9, but certainly there was like a 10th and 11th and a 12th. They're like, we're not putting that in there, but are still good advice. You got anything left on the editing room floor that are still worth bringing up?
Very opinionated ones. I think use TypeScript could be a pillar in a sense.
Right?
But do you want to make people angry? Like, even yourself? No.
Right.
Yeah, that we said use LTS, but we didn't say please don't use very old versions of Node.js, which should be a pillar. But that's common sense, right? We hope.
Yeah. Right.
On TypeScript, I want to be provocative.
Okay.
I came to enjoy the experience of writing TypeScript when building, working with a team and building an application. I absolutely think that the authorship story from a maintainer perspective, so somebody that is maintaining a lot of modules on NPM, it's so much better with JavaScript and writing the types manually that, you know, it's just like, okay, no, I'm probably not doing that. Like, it's the authorship story, it's so hard. Like, it makes maintaining these things so much harder. Like, I can maintain a lot of the modules that I maintain because just pure JavaScript is super easy to maintain, not a lot of toolchain.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's probably my, if I wanted to put it as an advice, I would, you know, TypeScript requires a lot of tooling around it to make it usable. And that's, it gives you a lot of benefits. So that's true. But if a maintainer with a very little time optimizing for time consumed is very often.
Have you looked into JSR, the Dino folks' new registry, and they're trying to make it super easy to publish TypeScript packages without...
It's a great step into the right direction, that means less TypeScript options and less, variability in the testing, in the tooling, and so on and so forth. It's a great step, okay? We have a few node messes to deal with at the moment, so unfortunately.
I have a controversial opinion.
Okay.
I mean, it's great for library authors, for dependency authors.
Right.
But in your application, you still need to transpile, right? So you still need the tooling.
Yeah.
If you're an application author.
Absolutely. Right.
So then you...
I think the sales pitch currently is on package authors. Is two package authors more than your regular app dev who still, like you said, yes, has the build tools anyways. Very cool. We've come to the end. Anything left unsaid? Anything you guys want to shout out or link to in the show notes? How to connect you? Of course, Platformatic is where you'll find the blog post. You'll also find it in our show notes. But anything else?
I want to send call to the other two authors, okay? Michael Dawson and... James Nell, everybody reviewed this, wrote part of it. It's been a good collaborative efforts. Okay. Yeah, that's probably my take. I want to make a key part, something very important that was not said. There's been a clear moment there, a movement there on supporting the maintainers financially. This is very important. And there's been very recently something called the Open Source Pledge. And I want to recommend major companies to contribute either developer time or money to the maintenance of the commons. Doesn't mean joining the pledge, but you need essentially everything use a lot of open source. And if you have a critical piece of open source that you rely on, sending some money to the maintainers usually helps them a lot. Or even just give them a job and an opportunity to do that work as part of your team. Mm-hmm. Note that last part is more important because a lot of big companies do not consider open source, public open source, as part of their promo packs, which is a huge, huge problem for a lot of people that wants to do this kind of good open source work. Okay, look, I'm doing all this work, but this is not getting me any benefits at my job. So why the heck I'm doing it? And at some point, you get burned out and everything goes to, goes all bad. So that's probably my last take. So please consider sponsor help. See how you can make the life of your maintainers easier, okay? And not try to be vampires and sucking the blood out of them and burn them out.
Well said. Natalia, any final words from you?
No. Second that pledge from Matteo and... Also get involved. Get involved in open source. As a developer, it's very, very rewarding.
Well said. Well, on behalf of Matteo Colina and Natalia Bendito, thank you for listening to this episode of JS Party. All the links to all the things are in your show notes. Shout out also to the other collabs on the doc. I think it's an excellent resource for the entire community. Thank you all for writing that. I'm Jared. This is JS Party, and we'll talk to you all on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That is JS Party for this week. Thanks for hanging with us. Did you know we're having a year-end merch sale? Yes, all changelog merch is discounted while supplies last. Get yourself or someone you care about some new threads for up to 40% off at merch.changelog.com. Big thanks once again to our partners at Fly.io, to our longtime sponsors at Sentry. Use code changelog, save $100 on a Sentry team plan. And to the one, the only, the Beat Freak, Breakmaster Cylinder. Thanks, BMC. Our shows wouldn't bump the same without you. Next up on the pod, Nick and K-Ball are back from React Summit US. While there, they had some great conversations, which we are packaging up and we'll have ready for your earholes next week.